Hi, welcome back to Books and Broomsticks. I'm Chaotic Witchaunt.
And I'm Matt Hatter Plays.
And today we have a very special guest with us who has been on our podcast before. Moses, please say hi.
Hey everybody, I'm Moses.
Okay. Can you tell us where we can find you on the interwebs?
Yes, definitely. Primarily on Instagram at HoodooMoses and also at HoodooMoses.com.
Amazing. Today we have a very fun topic. We are talking about High John the Conqueror route. And we're starting off with talking about what it is and its attributes.
Yeah, that's, well, there's some question as to what it is. And we'll talk, well, again, I will paint you guys a picture. I will connect some dots. They may make the shape of a question mark when all is said and done here, but we'll see. So the route that we know as High John the Conqueror route now is what we call Halapa Ipomoea. It's in the Morning Glory family. It's a tuber of that family. They're traditionally cultivated in Jalapa, Mexico, I think is the place, Jalapa, Mexico. And in the traditional cultivation, they're smoked with a particular herb to dry them. And that gives them that kind of signature smoky scent that if you know the root, that's part of it. And it's this very musky, sort of smoky, strong smelling root that we
smells, know. Smells like guy.
It smells kind of like you, yeah. Now, there's a lot of what's being sold as High John root that is certainly not. I spoke with a gentleman who is involved with a university laboratory who's kind of been collecting samples and testing them. And he's like, well, some of this stuff is like not even botanically related. Some is different, you know, cousins of the root, and some is the same. So that's a whole thing to start with. The other thing is, historically, we don't know that this root was always High John. There's some indication that what we call Archangel root, Angelica Archangelicus, Angelica root, used to also be called High John at one point, in certain you know, contexts. So there's maybe some confusion around that, but at least as long as I've been alive and known the root, it's always been High John root that we know today, a sort of brown, hard root that smells kind of smoky and like dude and potent.
I was really tempted to go grab the one off of my altar, currently doing some whatever it's doing, but it just looks like it's a ball. Yeah, it looks like that. Mine's a little more
like a scrotum is the idea, maybe.
Is there any particular uses for High John the Conqueror root? I ask this because I am not familiar with it. I've never used it.
Yeah, I mean, so it's really seen as a vehicle for, we'll say, integration or connection with the spirit of High John the Conqueror. You know, the story goes that he put his spirit in a root when he went back to Africa with the devil's daughter, which I guess we'll have to tell the story in a moment now, because that's given completely out of context. That's just a thing.
It gets wild and crazy very, very quickly.
But the idea being that he, in the same way that a saint, like a canonized saint, might imbue a relic with some connection to their spirit, the same being the case for this root and High John. So High John, it's more about kind of when you know his story and his character, that's kind of what the root affords us, I would say.
And yeah, it's definitely going to be, we'll try to shrink down the story, but I feel like
there are dozens of stories, so we won't tell, there's no way we could tell the whole story. But what we can say about High John's story is that, I'll give kind of the most contemporary version, is that he was a slave from the Congo Kingdom. He was a prince. He was brought to a plantation somewhere in the mid-Atlantic. And in the course of his enslavement, he consistently got over en masse and won his freedom, ultimately entering a wager with the devil, tricking the devil. A couple different stories of how he does it. Usually he kind of tricks or engages or seduces, however different versions, the devil's daughter to provide him with some advantage over the devil. He defeats the devil, gains his freedom, and goes back to Africa with the devil's daughter. So that's the kind of basic archetype of High John. Now, what we have, for example, in the work of Zora Neale Hurston, where she went down south and collected a bunch of High John stories, and we just have like the anecdotals. There are many anecdotal High John stories that kind of give us a glimpse at a situation in which he either through cleverness or through just sheer dumb luck comes out on top again and again. He's kind of this Brer Rabbit character. If you're not familiar with Brer Rabbit, maybe think a little bit, almost, well, Brer Rabbit's the basis for Bugs Bunny. So if you know Bugs Bunny, you kind of have a portal into this particular type of trickster who kind of like, whether by luck or by skill, inevitably comes out on top.
Mm-hmm.
And hence High John the Conqueror.
So, I mean, much as it usually is when folklore, right, it's all very anecdotal and it all depends on who's telling the story. Something I forgot to put into the outline, but it is very important that we have the conversation about. I know Moses has feelings as far as the next question that's going to come out of my face in general, but when we're actually talking about High John the Conqueror, there is a lot of conversation about whether or not he is available for everybody when it comes to being in plant format. A lot of people treat him in the same vein that we try to treat White Sage and things like that. Do you agree with that, or is he a little bit more of a open plant, an open source plant?
It's tricky one way or the other because of that direct association with an ostensibly human spirit. It's not purely a plant medicine, right? And for White Sage or for any plant medicine, if you want to use it in the tradition of that plant medicine, you have to receive the medicine from someone who keeps the medicine. Personally, I use a lot of things outside of the tradition of the medicine because I'm a human being and I can interact with the plant kingdom. And that is what it is, right? So, and I think that's fine. Now, will the spirit of High John respond to anyone? I would say theoretically, he could respond to anyone, but he will not respond to everyone. I'll put it that way.
Well, I was just going to say, I think when we get to seeing plants as not just High John as being imbued with the spirit of High John, but plants in general, there is a level to it, and even animals or spirits in general, there is a level to it where certain spirits are not going to respond to certain people. Or if they do respond, they're not going to respond well.
Yeah, I think that you hit it on the head there, Frankie. Like, the idea is we're dealing with spirits, whether it's an animal, a plant, a human being, dead or alive or somewhere else, an angel, a demon, anything else. We're dealing with the spirit. And just like with a human being, do I get along? Will I work with anyone? I mean, theoretically, yeah. But then if you say some disturbing stuff to me or behave in a way that I find objectionable, no, I won't work with you. If you treat me badly, I won't work with you. You know, I like to keep it as simple as that, right? Because we can wrap our heads around that. There are situations where, you know, can I be friends with anyone? Yeah, I guess I could be friends with anyone. And unless they reveal something about their character or nature that I find, you know, kind of that I don't like. And I'm more likely to be closer friends with someone who has a character or nature that I really enjoy. And I think that's the thing to keep in mind, whether we're talking about a specific roots in general, animal, you know, everything. It's like, do you have an internal sympathy? Like, and I mean like a harmonic sympathy. Like, are you guys on the same wavelength with what Absolutely. You're trying to connect with? Then you'll probably connect with it. And if you're not, it probably won't be a very clear connection. Probably won't work out great.
Okay. And I'm not 1,000% sure because you are, because as you said, we don't even know for sure if we have the right plan going into all of this. We need to talk about making sure that it's ethically sourced and that we're actually sourcing the correct thing. Is High John the Conqueror a endangered species or not?
As far as I know, it's not. It's a cultivated species. And I want to say on ethical sourcing, this is how, like I don't personally buy wildcrafted white sage. Mm-hmm. I buy cultivated white sage by the kilo because it's grown on a farm somewhere. Mm-hmm. You know, And so High John, because to get the root as we have it, it has to be harvested and dried and processed in this manner. It's not really wild harvested. You can find some wild dog High John out there. It's just not common.
I always personally have concerns about wild harvested endangered species because because there's such, and this is in specifics to white sage, there is such a huge black market for white sage, including it being stolen off reservations by people. As well as that, there are so many legal things around wild harvesting and foraging white sage in so many areas that it always concerns me, at least specifically with white sage, when they say wild harvested and they don't give much more information past that, because I have no idea where it was wild harvested. You could have wild harvested it and stolen it off a reservation, or you could have taken it from a national park, which you're not allowed to do. There's so many things that it comes when we look at foraging and wild harvesting. There's so many intricacies around not only being ethical about it, but being legal about it in the same way.
Go ahead. I feel like the best case scenario, because people, there's always the comeback about like, well, I don't want to use cultivated, I want to use the wild forage, because then you have the spirit of the place and all that. And like, in an ideal case, working for oneself, one would go out and gather the specific ingredient one wanted, making appropriate offerings, making sure it was in a, you know, a conservation compatible space, that one has no environmental impacts that are negative and things like that. And especially key emphasis on making the appropriate offerings, you know, interacting with the spirits of the place and all that. That would be the best case scenario. But
we live in a world where that's not always the case.
Beneath that, to me, is buying the cultivated rather than some random wild foraged, wild harvested. You know, we had talked about doing something on ethics around like animal parts, ethically sourced animal parts. I was talking with my wife about this morning, and I was like, well, what I have encountered in my sourcing of animal parts is the taxidermist's definition of ethically sourced, which is not poached, right? There's a hunting permit to go with the animal. Mm-hmm. And one assumes, hopefully, there's someone at a wildlife management department that is making sure that means sustainable. They're not issuing more tags than is sustainable, and that, you know, the hunting laws are ethical and all that. That's not really in my hands, but I know that if I get it from a taxidermist and they say it's ethically sourced, then at least that there was a tag that went with that animal to prove that someone had some oversight on that. Would it be better if I myself stayed in the woods until the animal presented themselves and I harvested the parts myself? It would. That would be much more powerful. But
that would also take a lot longer and not make any sense.
Realistically,
if the choice is ethically sourced or poached, you know, if it's like ethically farmed or poached, then it's, of course, it's farmed. There's no question about that. And I also just want to add, there's nothing new about this, right?
Mm-hmm.
Magicians, thousands of years ago, were waiting to buy frankincense from the caravan because it didn't grow in, you know, wherever they were. Like, this is very old stuff.
The add-on as well is, a lot of people often ask me, they're like, well, what is the best place that is ethically, like, what is ethically sourced? And I'm like, that is your moral set. That is your code of ethics.
Yeah.
Also,
I have, go ahead,
one
Matt.
I have one last practical question before we go into the magical aspects of the rest of this topic. Where could we find some ethically sourced roots and such? Where could we find that?
You can go to hoodoomoses.com and click Nothing But the Root on top. I did just ask to add Jezebel root and some other roots that are harder to find. I want to add one more thing before we go on to the magical, just to connect cultural around High John, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because this to me, again, if you got to get in the magical, you got to understand the personage, the spirit of High John, and making these cultural connections is going to make some things happen. So here's a weird thing, and this you can find in the book called,
oh, we love a good book drop.
Work in the Roots. No, not that one. Oh, it's working to root. Nope. It is. Shoot. I'm looking at the wrong one. I will find the book.
Man's got 5,000 different book titles.
I literally have the largest library of, especially on like Hoodoo, of actual like books. The largest one that I know of that's in one place.
Give me the book list or else.
So, okay, I will before we get off the air, especially considering that book is in the title of this podcast, I will locate this book and get you guys the exact...
Perfect.
Okay, so what I was going to say, and hopefully I'll find the book and you guys will find the book and you will see that whatever I got wrong in this retelling of the story is corrected by reading the right one. What I was going to say is that whole story that I told about Hijana, a slave from Congo. Oh, so there's another version that I have to give also where he doesn't go back to Africa. He escapes the plantation, or he escapes the plantation, goes back to Africa, then comes back to free others and lead them into sort of a guerrilla resistance movement that fought against the different plantation owners. So that story we don't have in any American histories. Doesn't mean it didn't happen. Just means that nobody wrote it down, or if it was written down, somebody destroyed it so we didn't find out about it. That stuff definitely happens. But we do have that story. Now, one of them, we have the story of Gaspar Yanga. I believe that's the gentleman's name, in Mexico. Okay, now this is interesting because the area of Mexico in which he was enslaved as a Congo prince who then escaped and then led a band of guerrilla rebels is Jalapa, Mexico, where the Jalapa root comes from. So was there at some point a recognition of the original Hijan mythos in this story, or was it something that said, oh, well, the root from that place has the same virtues? That's one possibility. Another thing I want to add, and this is very powerful, this is something that is relatively emerging research for me, is there's a character, I have to find out right now what country he is associated with. I know his name.
And by the way, y'all, Moses is basically my spirit dad, I've decided. So every time he's like, one more thing, I'm like, uh-huh, uh-huh. Yeah, okay.
Moses, the spirit dad.
I bug the shit out of this man. I'm just regularly just like, hey, what are your thoughts on this? Hey.
So dad. There's a character who is known as Sebastian Lemba. Okay, he was a Dominican slave, okay? I'm going to tell you a few things of Sebastian Lemba. Firstly, he was a member of the Lemba tribe. The Lemba are very interesting people. They claim to be descended from the biblical Hebrews. They claim to have an ngoma, a drum that is made from the wood of the Ark of the Covenant that defeats their enemies in battle and shoots fire. It explodes and they repair it. There's all kinds of stuff around it. A lot of what they have, when I talk to people of different African diasporic traditions, that's actually how I found out about the Lemba. And a lot of what they carry in their culture carried into and out of Congo, as they came from by way of Ethiopia through North Africa into Congo, and now the Lemba are settled in South Africa, and the way they live now is very much like biblical era Hebrews. It's pretty crazy. They slaughter their own meat. They have a priesthood. They keep the Sabbath with very strict biblical rules. All this stuff. So this dude, Sebastian Lemba, was of those people from when they were in Congo in the 1500s. Okay, Sebastian Lemba, I'm going to read right off Wikipedia, was an early Dominican slave rebel leader who led a prolonged Maroon rebellion in the colony of Santo Domingo. Born in Africa, a member of the Lemba tribe, when he was a young man, he was captured and taken to companies in France and Spain around 1525 and eventually transferred to Hispaniola. He revolted against the Spanish crown in 1532 and succeeded. Determined to liberate the island from slavery, he engaged in a 15-year-long Maroon rebellion, which subsequently went down in history as one of the first Maroon activities in the entire Americas. This guy, definitely a prince, definitely from Congo, definitely connecting, and he being of the Lemba is at this similar interesting intersection of the Hoodoo Conjure tradition where we see Hijan root. And so we have these actual historical figures, where personages, where we see these stories. Now, Lemba is like a pretty big deal. Gaspar Yanga, less a big deal. you know, there's a national statue of Limbo with his chains broken in the Dominican Republic. That's very much the image we have of Taiju. So understanding and connecting with some of these actual historical figures will connect us to, help us transition maybe here to, how would we connect with the spirit of Haijon? Well, I'd say get a feel for how these actual stories went. And there are books on these people. Like, it's not, these are not unknown stories. The Haijon is more in the world of mythos. Of course, we know that there definitely was not a Congo prince from Congo who was named Haijon. That's obviously not the case, right? So if you want to hear the stories of Haijon himself, then Zora Neale Hurston's writing, especially of mules and men, maybe a little bit in Barracoon, but really in of mules and men, that's where most of the Haijon stories from the American South I've seen are collected and written. And then, you know, looking at these parallel figures in history who may have been a basis or may just kind of connect us with that archetype, if you will.
What do named magical roots bring to the table? For example, Haijon, Jezebel root, which we're not talking about in this episode, but we could do an extra episode on, etc.
Yeah, well, so I can answer that question from a few different places. I'm just going to jump in. They give us a reference point. One thing, whenever we think of ritual, because these roots are from, you know, Palantir Hoodoo, was a ritual-based tradition, right? So whenever we think of ritual, ritual involves what in Greek is called anamnesis, a re-experiencing, a re-engagement. A ritual needs a point in the past that exists in sort of the liminal time and space. So I guess it's not in the past, a point in liminal time and space that it engages. And so when we have these named characters, they provide the point, right? The character, the personage of Haijon, which the average person here might not know, but the average person growing up in South Carolina 200 years ago, average black person, freed slave, growing up in South Carolina 200 years ago, would absolutely know Haijon.
And maybe hyper aware, yeah. And the reason I put
I have to correct myself, actually, because 200 years ago, there many of them would still be enslaved, actually, and would know Haijon, would have that a connection with that personage. It would have an emotional resonance. It would not simply be in like, hey, this is a weird looking root that has this weird smell. I do believe the smell of a plant is very important to its virtues and powers, both as a point of connection and an expression of them. But so then when we get to, you know, a Jezebel root, where this is connected with the figure, the personage of Jezebel from the Old Testament, or Queen Elizabeth root being another one. Now, obviously, some of these are not, I'm trying to think of other roots that are maybe named that this won't apply to. Well, I'll let you guys proceed with the question and keep perusing my bookshelves for that book.
This is exactly like what I wanted to bring to it, because when we look at things that are not named, there's just this very general air of what it does, right? Like, sure, there's absolutely stories, very specific stories about Mandrake, and we can bring those specific stories into the practice. But when it comes to actually like named roots, it just seems like there's a very specific, almost easily more recognizable attribute that comes into our practice and our ritual when we use those particular roots and plants.
I think the fact that we have, I think it makes it much easier to anthropomorphize the nature of the root, because we have a human or humanoid or human-esque personage attached in some way, because mm-hmm. that's where the name comes from, right? So, you know, the classic is Angelica. It's literally named Angelica Archangelicus. The scientific name of the root is Archangel, right? So from the beginning of there being a botanical cataloging of this root, at least in the European languages, it was associated with the Archangel Michael. To me, that's pretty incredible.
Wait, what?
Wait, babe, you didn't realize that?
That's why it's called Angelica root. Yeah.
That is literally, I have been using Angelica root for ages, and it's been one of those plants that I'm like, I love it. It's like native to my ancestor's town, and I've been using it a bunch of spells, one of my biggest herbal allies. That makes so much fucking sense. Of course it's Archangel Michael. Michael, who doesn't leave me alone and never responds to anything.
I want to give that book that I was talking about before, so you guys have it on the record. It is called Mojo Workin', The Old African-American Hoodoo System by Katrina Hazard Donald. It's out by University of Illinois Press. I can give my critiques about it. We could do book club. You know, there's things I absolutely adore about that book. One of those things being the historical scholarship, and it is excellent. I will say that the author has a clear, well, just like with any academic writing, the author has a thesis that she's out to prove. And so there's a particular bent. I would say that it's in her perspective, everything has a very Yoruba-based bent, like a particular culture cluster of West Africa. And it omits, I think, the strong emphasis of a lot of other African cultural contributions. That's just my take on it. You know, she's a teacher at a university. I'm just a guy who likes books, so I'm not picking any fights.
Oh, now please don't be doing that to yourself. I mean, you're actually pretty damn accredited, even though you're not at a not a professor at a university. My dude's got education back behind him. I think a lot of people forget that you're actually really fucking smart.
I do as much as I can to not dwell in that zone. But I will say that I do have a background in anthropology, cultural anthropology. My focus was on specifically this stuff in my undergrad. My master's degree is in writing with a focus on 20th century occultism and underground 20th century literature. So I've been studying the occult formal and magic and particularly this like cultural and subcultural bent on it formally and mostly informally for like 25-30 years. So I read some books. That's nothing more.
I read some books. You are the most. I thought I was like stubborn and humble. You are more stubborn and more humble than anyone I have ever met. I just read some books. Yeah, I have a master's degree and I'm pretty accredited. I just read books. I'm just a dude who
reads. That's all you do to get a master's degree. Like I could be fancy about it and put MFA after my name and all this shit. But really, all I did to get that was read some books. So kind of that's the substance of it.
Anyways, what are some examples of what we do with these roots?
Well, from a hoodoo perspective, conjure perspective, you know, number one is totem. Totem means to carry them. Not the word totem. Sorry, I just realized that we're listening to audio without transcription. But tote them. Let's say it with enunciate. Tote them, carry them.
Yeah.
Right. You tote the root, and that's a twofold thing. First of all, that practice seems to have been. It certainly has precedent in Africa, though. Generally, it would not be an individual root. It would be a compound of roots or an effigy. Kind of made of from a root, and we'll talk about how that technically works magically as well. But the practice of simply carrying a root, a plant's root, to have a concentrated source of the virtues of that plant seems to come from indigenous American. What's the preferred term in this setting? Do we say Native American, indigenous American?
I mean, for me personally, I do not care. I have learned that people call it whatever they want to. My preferences myself are indigenous. It's fine.
Cool. Then we'll just go into indigenous Americans because it actually seems to be a practice from a few different culture groups. And we see that what we consider charms. I was actually just watching a very, very interesting YouTube, which I will dig up and provide to you guys later so you can link, of an American ethnobotanist who stumbled into the world of hoodoo roots, just kind of just went around, and he's a pure like plant medicine, like what do you use this for? And ethnobotany is fascinating, right? Ethnobotany is basically, you know plants really well, and then you go around to different people and show them a plant that you know, and ask them what they use it for and what they call it and all that stuff. So he goes around, ends up in South Carolina with, I think, Hijon actually, some other roots, whatever, and showing them to people and saying, what do you use it for? And they say, well, to tote, to carry. And he's like, what in the world is that? And then so he starts exploring more and finding that there's accounts of Native American, what they call charms, right? People were calling these charms, of, you know, if a kid's teething, you hang a, I think it was a lovage, no, I can't remember what root it was, but you hang the root around their neck to stop the teething. And he's like, well, I know medicinally that root has these properties, but this, this, and this. And then he starts talking through it and being like, oh, the kid's teething. So the drool, and the drool hits the root, and that makes it topically active. And they absorb some small amount of that active ingredient. And it's not a charm, it's a medicine. And this maybe leads us to understanding some of the application of medicine bags. When I first saw mojo bags, I heard of medicine bags long before I heard of mojo bags. I'd heard of medicine bags when I was like an adolescent, and I didn't see a mojo bag till I was in college, and I met a conjure man. But the idea of a bundle that has certain botanicals in it that you wear or carry in a place close to your body, that's something we have in all our traditions. It seems that at least on some level, there may have been some pharmacological
purpose.
Let me put that in present tense. There may still yet be some pharmacological activity.
Well, we
and
have,
this is where I get to toting a hijon root. Because you put that root in your pocket, you feel it. You put that root in your pocket, and it starts to heat up, and it starts to kind of mix with your... They say it has to mix with your smell. Your smell. That's what they always say. Keep it in your armpit. Keep it in your underwear. Keep it close to your body. Keep it warm and moist. Well, yes, that will start to mix with your smell. There is a spiritual and soul-based connection that's occurring. Also, if there's anything to this theory that this botanist has, it's also providing it a little bit of heat, a little bit of moisture to make an oil extraction of the oils on the surface of the root and put those right into your skin. And to me, it's not an either or. It's a both.
Yeah. I mean, I'm thinking even about like in Italian American folk magic, we have bowls, we have like little bags, we have bevy bags, mm-hmm. and typical in here would be garlic, which is basically seen as being imbued with the spirit of Saint Michael in a lot of ways.
That's another one that's directly connected to Michael is garlic. Yes,
garlic. I love garlic in this house. I am a garlic girl. I use garlic a lot. So you take like whole cloves of garlic, a saint metal, and it's typically a black bag tied with a red ribbon. Red and black ribbons have huge significance in Italian and Italian American folk magic. But I just think about the way in which this is similar to other folk magics that I've seen of like putting something that imbues a spirit in a bag and carrying it with you.
Interesting also how these things have like a magical explanation and operated and functioned. Like people were like, oh man, evil spirits are gonna come fucking kill us.
Mm-hmm.
We need to come up with a way to do it. And then there's a bag. And then we are like, now we have a new paradigm. We don't call it evil spirits, we call it disease. And now we still are like, oh, but those things in the bag are antibiotic and that's how it's working. Right.
Yeah.
But if you went from calling it disease to calling it an evil spirit.
All I'm saying is garlic has antimicrobial properties and antibacterial properties, and like chewing it, eating it, all of this does in not all cases, but in some cases protect against disease. There's even an old midwife's tale in which if you have a yeast infection, you take garlic and you stick it up your vagina.
Nice.
To heal the yeast infection. And while that doesn't actually work, the protective aspects of garlic and the antibacterial, the antimicrobial, they go hand in hand. Seeing Archangel Michael as the protector against the wickedness of the devil, and the devil being rooted to like dark, like magic and spells, especially in Italy, and like the evil eye. It's like really interesting, and it's always fun to find that like explanation of like, oh,
yeah. And that's exactly where the interconnectedness comes from. I mean,
what I would challenge you guys and your listeners to do is to, once you find that interconnectedness, follow it back and then try to flip the perspective to the other side.
Mm.
Right? Because what happened was the germ theory of disease came out. And the germ theory of disease is a very functional model for treating disease and developing treatments for disease. But it is just a model in the way that the model of an atom doesn't actually, like, that's an atom is actually like these, if you look at it under an electron microscope, is this pulsating crazy thing. It's not like planet with the orbiting steady rings, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's a model that lets us wrap our heads around it, that we can do science from, and that's great. Wow. It's really useful, but it's just a model. And so everything's kind of these weird fields of probability, including disease. I'm not saying germs aren't real, don't get me wrong, but they're not like the causal agents. There aren't these like you know, a board meeting of germs, you know, the War Council of Germs being like, okay, we're coming to get the humans. Like, there's something going on that mm-hmm. these germs are riding. And so it's like, are you treating the cause or treating the effect? And we get back to that magical medical connection, which was absolutely the same fucking thing, like, not too long ago. We can start to see, we can start to understand magic a lot better.
Yes.
A lot more like medicine. And the idea of making spiritual medicines and treating a particular spiritual condition with a particular spiritual medicine or a particular root, or working with a particular saint or energy for mm-hmm. a particular cause, is just that much more like straight and clinical to me. So I really appreciate that point.
Yeah. To finish us off, I want to give both Moses and Matt, because Matt, I'm not sure if you worked with Hydron. Have you?
I have very cautiously worked with Hydron because my knowledge base isn't the highest on it. So
that's okay. Yeah. Moses, do you have any personal stories of that you had using the Hydron the Conqueror route that you would like to share?
Oh, I mean, you know, weird probability bending, sure.
Yeah.
I have to say that I was never just toting a Hydron.
Yeah.
I had my whole array. So I can't say that. Yes. But, well, because you dress, like, you know, from hat to shoe, something's going on.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I can say some things that happened, like, in that context that it was like, oh, I just got this new big Hydron root and I was happened to be toting it for these situations, right?
Yeah.
So, one was, man, I actually don't even understand how this happened. But so, one of the kind of more traditional ways to tote a root is you carry it, yes, but the other thing is when you carry it, it's a secret. No one knows about it. No one sees it. No one touches it for damn sure. But then when no one's around, you speak to it. It's a bit like the idea of the homunculus. If we're connecting it across magical traditions, often you baptize it in your own name or little yourself and then carry it on you. And so it's like a little version of you that's like a little helper you. And we encounter that in a bunch of different traditions in a bunch of different forms. But then you talk to it in between and you tell it like, okay, John, or Lil Moses, whatever, I forget what I named that one. Usually Hydron roots, I name John. Okay, John, we're going to the airport right now. We're late as hell, my friend. I'm going to need your help with this one. You know, we're going to be moving around. And letting them know, just like you would with a child, or even the way people talk to a pet. So it becomes this endearing little you that you carry. And it can help.
I do that with my fox spirits, because when I don't, they throw fucking tantrums. I forgot to tell one of them that I was like packing up the altar as I was doing it. And then throughout the day, doors open and close by themselves. Things were moved like rooms away. And then I moved here and because I'm in a new space and I unpacked him right away and nothing has happened. I'm like, thank fucking, oh no, we had one thing happen. I did have a protection candle go wonky. And I am convinced that it is the spirit because he was like, ah, you haven't unpacked me yet. Are you expecting me to help you with this?
Oh, I've had that when I move. Definitely. And yeah, well, I don't want to go too far on a tangent here. So the story, which I didn't tell yet. So I'm on the way to the airport and I'm like, all right, John, we're going to miss this flight, bud. So, you know, let's have a lucky chance when we get to, you know, whatever's going to happen. I'm going to have to be at the airport for a few extra hours. How about a lucky chance encounter? Bring in someone good. Because I was like, the flight, I don't know, 30 minutes from the airport, doors close in 15 minutes. I don't know what happened, but I made the flight.
Nice. Solid. Like,
I don't understand. And obviously the flight was delayed. They had to clean the plane, whatever. Stuff was just put back the right amount. But I made the flight. And that happened two or three times within a few months when I was really traveling a lot. And I was like, yeah, I can leave the hotel when the flight is boarding because of course I'm going to make the flight. And I eventually did run out. I didn't have my route on me. So that's one thing. Just the main thing about the Hydron route is once you start toting it, and I should say, traditionally speaking, I'm not going to get into any debates on this. I'm just speaking as an ethnographer now. Traditionally speaking, Hydron is for men and Queen Elizabeth roots for women. And we'll say male presenting or Hydron augments the masculine energy. Queen Elizabeth root augments the feminine energy. So anyone wanting to augment the masculine energy can properly tote a Hydron. but be mindful that it's not just like, oh, having dominance, having control, having luck. It's a particularly strong masculine energy of that. And the female equivalent, or feminine equivalent, I should say, is the Queen Elizabeth. So depending on like where you're presenting and which type of that energy you want to strongly augment your own with, select mindfully. That's the first biggest.
Can you work with both?
There will be they interact is what I want to say. I don't want to say they don't get along, but they interact and you're not getting a straight. They're more concerned with each other than with you.
Got it. So you wouldn't,
how you would do that if you were in some intergender place.
Yeah.
The way that at least I typically will look for it. It's, and if you want to buy a root and with this in mind, you should definitely contact me or contact whoever you're doing, because it's a bit of a pain. But you can find, there are female Hijon roots.
Interesting. And that would be
a Hijon root that looks like, especially like a vulva. I also have male Queen Elizabeth roots, which are just like really foul, right? So those would be somewhere in, and depending on whether you would choose a phallic Queen Elizabeth root or a yonic Hijon root, which you would go with, that's going to be a very personal decision, but we can unpack kind of the significance one way.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
Got it. I know a lot of our listeners are like queer, non-binary, etc. Right. And I wanted to discuss those choices because, I mean, I wouldn't necessarily say use both roots at once because those are two very powerful energies that you may not want to like. It's kind of like
you're just kind of stuck in the middle if you do.
Yeah.
And I don't mean like stuck in the. You're like stuck in the middle of Hijon and Queen Elizabeth. Mm-hmm. Like they're doing their thing, and you're a passenger for the ride. And it's not really going to serve the same purpose to run both. And generally, like, I mean, another old way of working it, because you would use these as effigies, right? That one kind of homunculus method I mentioned, you're making an effigy of yourself and totem. Mm-hmm. But in a working, if I want to do a love domination spell, and I want, in this case, I'll just use straight, you know, cisgendered woman and man, or mm-hmm. whatever, female and male. I'll get a big Queen Elizabeth root if she's going to dominate him. I'm going to get a big Queen Elizabeth root and a small Hijon. You see, so that one's stronger. And then I'll tie them together. I'll baptize each of them respectively and tie them together type thing. That, I don't really like doing love binding spells, but that would be that kind
that's
of
really
love.
Cool and really interesting to like work through.
Yeah, and that's the one thing about, unfortunately, buying roots online, which is how, on for now, all I can do with them. Although maybe I can put in a little plug at the end here and we can address that. But the shape of the root, the nature of the root is expressed in its form. That's a basic idea of doctrine of signatures, right? So if the form of the root is expressing its nature and you want a particular nature, then find a root that's shaped like that. You know. So the one thing I do, I can't go past the Hijon discussion without discussing, because I realize this is what's implied in the can everyone work with Hijon.
Mm-hmm.
I get the kind of like talk around it answer and be like, well, if you get along with him, you can work with him, which is true. But Hijon is a revolting African slave. Straight up.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
If you can get with that energy and that energy can get with you, it'll work. If you want that energy to get with you, but you haven't necessarily, and again, I want you to think about like a revolutionary militant,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, so if with considerable due respect, if you're like about meditation and peace, Hijon might not dig your vibe that day. That's not what he's about.
Yeah.
Right? Like that's, yeah. And that's with any spirit that we're talking about. Like you may respect him. You may admire him. You may have a great deal of affection for him. But whether that will be reciprocated has a lot to do with who you are.
Yeah.
Are you standing Hijon, or do you get along with Hijon? There's two very different questions. And that's the thing to consider. And I strongly recommend, if you want to work with Hijon, like put your own ass on the line in some way for African American or like Central West African causes. Any and every time, if that's part of your natural life because that's your community, then you're already doing it.
Yeah.
But if it's not part of like what you're doing, I made High John prayer cards and gave 150%, or maybe it was just 110%, I don't remember, more than 100% of the sales to an African-American charity that we all chose, right? Like, that was my devotion on that. And that worked well. Worked well with High John, worked well, you know. But there was a twofold aspect. Is I was putting in my labor for free, right? And I was making a personal sacrifice and paying out of my pocket on top of it, paying some reparation on that.
Yeah.
There you go.
Be mindful of how you approach it. That's what I must add that caveat.
Oh, yeah. I think that's really important to discuss too, especially because I don't want someone to listen to this and be like, oh, I'm going to pick up a High John route. And they're like not approaching it the right way.
It would be hilarious, mostly because it just wouldn't be effective.
On the one hand, it wouldn't be effective. That would be hilarious. It also just like be a dick move. It's disrespectful. It's cultural. That's cultural appropriation.
Are there any final thoughts from anyone?
Yes, I have something. I want Moses pretty pleased to tell me about Makerspace, and I also want Moses to tell me about his root business, because I really want this to be somewhere where where a lot of people from Colorado, first off, have a place to go, and I also want people to start sourcing ethical and not shit ingredients.
And for folks who haven't bought roots before, the context, I have a background in botanical buying from the cannabis industry. I literally, my job was to judge the quality of fresh and harvested plants for like years. So just botanical grading and sourcing is something I know really well. I can have it just, that's what I did. So that's what goes into the difference between different root selection, and how it plays out is size, form, smell, freshness, density. All these things are like how you feel it in a root. When you hold a good root, whether you get it from me or anyone else, a good root should feel like kind of like weirdly heavy in your hand. Like if you've ever held lead and you're like, that's heavier than that looked, a good root should always be a little bit heavier than it looks. And it should be well-formed, sized. It should have a strong fragrance if it's properly kept. One of the things that happens with roots, just the nature of the bulk root game, and it is all bulk botanicals, they ship them in these huge bags, okay? So if you ever ship a bunch of things of different size or store a bunch of things of different sizes in a gigantic bag, what happens is the little ones settle to the bottom, the big ones all kind of stay where they're at and get, and so when someone reaches in the bag to sell that or ship that, they just take out the big ones. And then at the end, you have about a half of the bag that's all the little ones. And most people sell High John by the piece. So it's the same price for a big one and little one. So one of the two things I do try to bring to it with what we're doing with the roots is first thing I do is take them out, great amount, anything that's below what would be a larger XL for someone else, that gets set aside for me to make into a hydrosol oil, whatever else. I only sell the larger roots. I only sell the roots that I quality check, because I thankfully have the infrastructure, and this will segue into the makerspace because I know we're coming up on time here, because we have the infrastructure to then make something with all of them. Like, I'll put all the little ones in the distillation apparatus and make High John water, which is fantastic and is not a product that is made anywhere because it's such a specialty thing. Now I can do that. We can offer that, you know, and now increasingly economically with the new equipment. The final step for this and to bring this all together with people is the Makerspace project, which thankfully I'm still tying up loose ends on and have not officially announced and launched yet. So this podcast will be highly relevant to it. And I can solicit the lovely listening audience and our wonderful hosts to please be involved in whatever way you feel called. You know, one of the things I do is I operate Holy Mountain Spiritualist Temple. We're a 501c3 religious church organization. When you hear church, we're not a Christian church, we're a magical church. So all this stuff that we talked about, that's my religion. It sounds like it's your guys' religions. So you're all welcome to be members, right? If you believe this stuff is real and you live your life based on it, and this is the spiritual reality you subscribe to, it's your religion. According to the U.S. government, that's what we're there for. One thing we want to do, though, is to have a physical space and to have a physical community space where everyone is welcome under that umbrella of, hey, you believe this magic is real? Cool. That's our religion. Welcome. Two, all these resources that I'm talking about develop, having developed, whether it's the candle making stuff, the distillation stuff, the kind of the alchemy lab, the ritual space. I have a whole ritual temple with all these tools and stuff like that. All these things that I got with the intention of being communal resources, and then a pandemic happened, to have a space finally for them to be communal resources. And now there's way more resources than ever. If you were like, hey, I want to make an oil, you could show up there, learn how to make the oil, get all the ingredients for the oil, get trained on the equipment, then either with guidance or without guidance, make that oil for yourself, and then use the bottling machine to bottle it up for all your friends and family. You know, if you happen to have a, you know, entrepreneurial venture in the space, that would be something like a business membership where you would pay at a different level because it's commercial. But the idea is a nonprofit space where we can bring these resources together, where people are welcome and encouraged to come and gather and learn. And yeah, if you want to try something, that's kind of the big idea with maker spaces as a concept. If you want to try something, I want to try 3D printing. I don't want to go invest in a 3D printer. So I would go to a makerspace. I would spend, I don't know, $150 or whatever on the class learning how to use the 3D printer and the materials. And then after that, I would take out time for whatever the cheap rate is to use the 3D printer and either decide like, oh, okay, I invested $200. I made this sweet thing. I like 3D printing, or I don't. And I didn't buy a 3D printer, and I learned about 3D printing and all that. But more often than not, when I go to makerspaces, and there was a period where just like when I was traveling a lot, actually, I would always try to hit a makerspace in whatever city I went. Just the conversations and the opportunities to learn, they're very parallel, you know, horizontal organizations. There's a board that determines the organizational stuff, but in terms of content, that's all kind of user determined. And the idea is like, yeah, we all gather, you know, maybe this is a hypothetical, but first Wednesday of every month will be beginner's alchemy night. You know, if you're new or inexperienced with alchemy and want to check it out, come on down.
That would be so cool. And,
you know, and for every topic, right? Beginner's candle magic night, beginner's ritual night. It'll give us a space to do kind of the seasonal rituals, the moon-based rituals and things like that. Where it comes into the religious aspect and intertradition aspect, like, does that mean I want these weird, like, potluck gumbo rituals? If it fits in the framework, yes, but also, like, respecting different people's practices, it's going to be attuned to the practice I keep and the lineage I carry, because that's the only thing I really feel like I can provide to people. If people feel like they can come and jive with it, then yeah, everybody's welcome. There's no, like, initiatory requirement or anything of that nature. And yeah, I hope to provide at least a gathering and discussion and learning space for all paths. And to the extent that I can provide practice resources to all paths and potentially like practice space, that too.
Yeah, that's and it's something that I was just really excited to hear about, because there's just not a lot of magical workspace anywhere. Everybody's always constantly having their own issues at home with space. I mean, there's a lot of people who are on the quote-unquote broom closet. A makerspace would be perfect for all of these things, and I really wanted to make sure that we talked about it, because the fact that we're now going to have a space available in our own backyard is really fucking cool.
That is the one catch, man.
Ah,
because it's a Kickstarter fundraiser campaign, right? I have the vision, I have the materials, I have the resources, I have the equipment, I have all that. But it's all in my house right now, and I can't have you guys all in my house. So
what do you mean?
Space is what we got to do, right? So now, depending on what I will pledge to everyone, is that the success of the campaign will determine on if we can get a space. And further, the greater success of the campaign, the greater space we will get for our needs. Like, ideally, I would buy a house, or, you know, I don't think we're going to be in a buy situation, but probably rent a light industrial commercial space where we can set up like a real lab with like high school lab tables and all the real stuff to do these classes, bring in not just my expertise, which is relatively limited, but the true like leading global experts on these topics to us as a community. So that's what the Kickstarter campaign's about. I'm going to give you guys the link to help spread it. If you go to that link and it says sign up to find out more, sign up to find out more, because that's what helps us get to the point where we can launch the campaign. And if the campaign's live when you see that link, please consider pledging. Everything you're going to get for pledging, whether it's just my thanks and heartfelt appreciation or one of the cool rewards that we have at the higher tiers is really special and specific. You know, we're going to have, for example, not just replicas, but like the exact same, what I have, the exorcism knife I had made that I use in exorcism that I made to old grimoire spec, the exact same guys making in the exact same ways. All these things that, cool ritual tools, very cool experiences. And of course, memberships to the makerspace, whether you want to be an in-person member or a virtual supporter, or however you want to get involved in back, your backing is literally whether or not this space can exist and all these possibilities, or whether this magic comes to pass. I'm taking that out of my hands and putting it in the community hands to make a community resource.
Perfect. That was my really big want to really talk about, not only because I love having Moses around here and that he has a lot of expertise and a lot of educational resources, but also because this is a really cool opportunity, and for once I wanted to support something on here just because we can, and also because we want a witchy, and I was really proud of that, and I thought that maybe we should celebrate by hopefully passing the resources in the community to somebody mm-hmm. who I think would be able to use it a hell of a lot more than two kids doing their best.
Well, you two kids doing your best, like, let's I dare say probably not your best yet, because you don't have all the resources at your fingertips, and you guys can come to my house. I don't know if I can invite all your listeners to my house. Stuff, but
on my way, let's go.
I'm coming. But thank you so much for joining us today, Moses. We look forward to having you again in the future. This has been Books and Broomsticks. I'm Chaotic Witchot.
I'm Matt Hatter Plays.
I'm Hoodoo Moses.
And we'll talk to you guys next week. Oh my god, I thought we weren't recording. We are.